The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Teju Cole is a novelist and an essayist who writes widely about photography and many aspects of the culture we live in. He's the author of Blind Spot and many other books. Last week, Cole joined me to talk, for reasons that are pretty obvious, about the history and the meaning of blackface. Now, Teju, I've got to ask, what went through your mind when you first saw the photo that everybody's been talking about, the governor of Virginia, either in blackface in a photograph of his medical school yearbook or his admission that at one time he had dressed up in blackface in the 80s?
Right. Well, I think like many of us, I received that information in a kind of a second or third hand. What I mean is that I was already seeing commentary about it before we even understand what the facts of the case are. In this case, the facts were not clear at all. And since Ralph Northam kept changing his story, it wasn't actually clear what kind of responsibility we were talking about here. Was he the one in the picture? It wasn't clear at all. The only strange thing about seeing this particular little thing explode was how unsurprising it was.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that a white man of a certain age in the U.S. is found to have done something racist in their past. Well, yes, this is a racist country, and we seem to think that each time it happens, it's somebody who is a bit of a unicorn. But what the only thing that happened here is that he was caught.
Do you think he should resign?
It sounds terrible to say so, but I actually don't care what he does one way or the other. What I'm interested in is what kind of conversation is possible out of an incident like this that is not the same old Groundhog Day. Because what I really see here is that it was bad to do what he did. And it was bad for his attorney general to also be in blackface. But how far does that badness go? The public reaction is interesting to me because we think these are bad actors and they should be punished for what they have done. We seem to have an automatic way of talking about that. This person should resign. It's offensive and they're racist. We don't know if they've changed.
In other words, that it's isolated an individual.
Well, what do you do about somebody who, let's say in the 1980s, refused to rent to black people? What do you do about somebody who acted in such a way that they got black people fired or blocked their access to mortgages? How do we talk about the fact that right now in this country, wealth inequality between black people and white people is cavernous? It is immense. That is racism. And yet, I don't suppose most white Americans wake up in the morning and feel personally responsible for that state of affairs. So if Northam resigns, on the one hand, it's the right thing to do. On the other hand, if he resigns, it serves a kind of a valve function of which this country seems to frequently require an example.
In other words, it takes the pressure off and we move on and fail to deal with the heart of things.
It takes the pressure off.
It seems to me that this is, obviously, this is the symptom of a much deeper, more widespread disease. And it has been with us for hundreds of years in one form or another. With blackface, just this one manifestation, blackface seemed to recede from the culture during the civil rights movement. And then during the rise of affirmative action, you started seeing it more and more on college campuses, clearly as some kind of reaction.
Right. I mean, it's sort of how, you know, it was after Reconstruction that all these Civil War Confederate monuments went up, right? So there's this sort of like delay, or there's this like a sleeping virus. But the thing with blackface is that it never really disappeared from popular culture, right? I mean, you know the long list of people that we might otherwise admire who have, in one form or the other, done blackface. As Ted Danson, of course, Fred Astaire, there's Billy Crystal, you know, Shirley Temple, Frank Sinatra, and so on. So I think what it shows is that black people could always be insulted or could always be assumed not to be in the audience that the joke was for. Because after all, this is what it comes down to, a kind of, who are we addressing here? And if we say, well, what Ralph Northam did was problematic, what's problematic about it is not shoe polish on his face. It's that he somehow did not see his black neighbors as fully equal. And he did not imagine a future in which he might have to deal with them as fully equal.
Teju, you were born in the United States in Kalamazoo, Michigan, but you didn't grow up here. You grew up in Nigeria and came here as a...
Yes, I was 17 when I came to the U.S.
For university. Do you have memories of coming here as a teenager and encountering some of this racial imagery for the first time? What were your first memories of that?
Well, I came to the U.S. and I came back to the U.S. as a college student in 1992. And I think at that time when I came here, I did not really understand American racial politics or America's racial history. And this is a peculiarity of the way that African-American history has gone out into the diaspora. So much of it comes to us through a white filter. So, for example, this might sound very odd to you, but when I was growing up, one of my favorite movies was Blazing Saddles, with its extremely foul language and very, very broad humor, very often at the expense of black people or stereotypes about them. And it was Mel Brooks humor. It was gross-out humor. Of course it would appeal to a 10-year-old. So being in the U.S., and I've been here for about 27 years almost now, has been about learning how insidious racism in this country is.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this is because you're a deep student of photography, and this issue got raised yet again because it shows up in a photograph that's particularly potent.
That's right.
When you look at, as a critic of photography, as a historian of photography, how does that help you understand American racism, these countless images?
Well, one of the things that I'm most convinced about when it comes to photography is actually a kind of definition in the negative, which is that it is an extremely limited art form. A photograph is made in 1/25th of a second, 1/60th of a second, you know. If it's a long exposure, maybe half a second or 1 second. Everything before that moment, everything after it, we really don't have. And so if I do see somebody in a photo doing something that seems to be racist, my first assumption is that, well, there's a lot more where that came from. not only in that person's personal life and in their history, but in the society that created that.
You know, we use this phrase all the time, over and over again, but is Northam in any way a tipping point? Is there the possibility that this can be used beyond him, beyond his survival, non-survival in his office, that it can be used in a useful way? He's talking about a reconciliation tour, for example. Forget his reconciliation tour. What should reconciliation look like?
David, I think I've learned that when it comes to race in America, there is no tipping point. I mean, there's no tipping point with cesspools. It's just going to be this very, very slow cleanup process. But people have to be willing to do that. I don't see that willingness, really.
Do you think somebody like Barack Obama was overly optimistic? He would talk about, you know, he would employ the King phrase about the arc of justice and feeling always that it's two steps forward, one step back, but there is progress. You seem much darker in your view.
Yeah, I think President Obama mistook his remarkable personal story for a general truth, and it's just not one that really holds. When we consider who succeeded him in the presidency, we already see that was not the case. Now, it's also possible that there is a samba going on here. There's like two steps forward, one step back. It's possible. But I don't know. Maybe it's one step forward, two steps back. You know, the samba is also
that seems to be the recent samba.
Right. The samba is a complicated dance. Yeah. And then there's all kinds of improvisation and there's sideways moves. But I don't want to end on a negative note because, I mean, you are a keen observer of history, and so maybe you'll agree with me on this, is that when societal change happens, it happens at such a velocity that it takes even the experts in that particular area by surprise. If you consider the speed at which public acceptance for the rights of queer people has happened in this country, it does feel precipitous also. And yet that's like, you know, 50, 60, 100 years of an overnight success.
Exactly. Teju Cole, thank you so much. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, David. Thank you.
Teju Cole contributes to The New Yorker and many other publications, and he teaches creative writing at Harvard University.